This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today on the Afternoon Magazine, running the Yukon Quest International Sled Dog Race. Journalist John Balzar has lived on the trail, and he writes about the 1998 race in Yukon alone, the world's toughest adventure race. The race is a long one, 1,023 miles from Whitehorse in Canada's Yukon Territory to Fairbanks, Alaska. How long is that? Think of the space between Chicago and Denver. Of course, the landscape and conditions are much different. Much of the quest is run in the dark, in sub-zero temperatures. Quests are never called off because of darkness or the severity of the weather. The top finisher wins $30,000. Everyone who finishes receives a patch, and as you might imagine, those patches are worn with pride. Listeners, I invite your questions about sledding in the far north and the Yukon Quest this afternoon. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Our guest, John Balzar, is a roving correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He's a recipient of the Scripps Howard Foundation Prize for Human Interest Writing. He joins us this afternoon from Chicago. He's in the Chicago area for a reading, slideshow, and book signing at the bookstall in Winnetka at 7 p.m. this evening. The bookstall located at 811 Elm Street in Winnetka. Yukon Alone, now available in paperback from Owl Books, a division of Henry Holt. Again, our telephone numbers 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. John, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for your interest. I'm happy to be here.
Is this year's quest underway?
It started on Sunday.
Okay. And starting this year in Fairbanks?
Starts this year in Whitehorse.
Fairbanks
and Whitehorse swap the rights each year to host the start of the race. And it started in Whitehorse this year.
And have you heard anything yet?
Well, you know, I haven't. This is the kind of event that you want to savor a little bit. That's why I wanted to write a book. And this race isn't really a lot about winning, except for a few people. It's more about getting out with nature and enjoying a real adventure, and that's the kind of stuff I want to savor. So I'm going to resist the temptation of trying to listen in on some long-distance radio show or something, and I'll get up there, and as soon as I'm through with this book tour, and we'll sit around a campfire somewhere, and that's how I'll hear about it.
Yeah, you'll hear the stories then. Many of the reporters that cover this event think of it as a sporting event. I have a feeling that you don't think of it necessarily as a sporting event, even though it is a race.
Well, there aren't really that many reporters who cover it. There are probably two or three each year, the Whitehorse newspaper and the Fairbanks newspaper. The year I happened to be up there was a little different in that a German sponsor, had given a big slug of money and brought some German reporters over. They unfortunately took it as a race, like a Formula One race, and it turned out not to be exciting as a race. People are spread over hundreds of miles of wilderness. Didn't work too well on television. Wanted more thrills and spills. And how exciting is it to watch dogs huff along at 6 miles an hour? Turned out to be great for a writer, however.
Yeah. Well, it's such a wonderful story, but yeah, for a television camera, it's not all that exciting.
That's why many people haven't actually said, you know, I saw that on TV. It's a marvel when I go talk to people in public. It's one of the few things that I've ever done that someone said, oh, yeah, I didn't see that show on TV.
Well, give us some idea of the terrain the mushers and their dogs face out there.
Well, this race looms out of the old gold rush traditions up there. That's how people got around. We may recall Jack London. And in fact, the trails of from Whitehorse to Fairbanks follow a lot of those old gold rush trails. A lot of it is on the Yukon River, a big, mighty, frozen river. It goes over several mountain passes, 4,000-foot mountain passes. But this is the interesting thing about it is that it's so wild. If we stop and think about the open space in America, the furthest you can get anywhere in a road in the lower 48, the furthest is 20.3 miles. And up there, you can get 150 miles, and this race goes 150 miles from a road. So you add that to 40 below, and you're near the Arctic Circle, as you said, and it's dark up there. You really get the feeling that you're far away.
Tell us about the snow. This was very interesting just to think about what's beneath your feet and the air that you're breathing. Tell us about the snow and the air that is out there for these folks and their dogs.
Well, people in the Midwest have a sense that there are degrees of cold. And I spent some time here as a young man, and so I know the kind of the Midwest range of cold. There's a whole other level of cold beyond that. When you get 40 and 50 below, snow isn't like little flakes. It falls like grains of sand. It's abrasive. At 50 below, a breath of air can scald your throat. If you were to take a handful of M&Ms out of your outside pocket and pop them in your mouth, you'd end up in the hospital with a scalded throat. So the degrees of temperature and the are so much more dramatic. In fact, sometimes life-threateningly so.
Mm. So how do you live out there?
Well, you bundle up good and warm, mm-hmm. and you feed your dogs a lot. These are, we have the kind of image of a sled dog as these 140-pound brutes that Jack London wrote about. Well, the guys that run this race up there today started with the Siberian Husky, and then they added a little, hound and Labrador and a few other things to them, and whatever somebody thought might make a good, hardy, fast dog. And they end up about 50 pounds, and the way they stay warm is that they eat a lot. They eat about 10,000, a 50-pound dog eats about 10,000 calories a day. That's a lot of food. That's about 25 quarter-pounders with cheese. And a person, you can warm up with gear. You just hope that when you take your glove off, you know what you're doing, because if I had the experience where you take a glove off and then your hand stops working and you can't get the glove back on, always kind of on the edge of danger.
Mm. Now, the dogs are not eating quarter-pounders with cheese. What are they eating?
Well, they're eating... You talk to a dog musher up there, and they have all of these elaborate menus and formulas. Traditional mushers tend to feed dogs wild game. They feed them slabs of fish, for frozen fish, for snacks. As it gets colder, they feed them fattier meat food, moose. You get real cold, and you feed them balls of beaver fat. And it sounds fairly unappetizing. I'm afraid that I have to report that freeze-dried dog food is now coming into fashion, so it's kind of like the stuff that backpackers carry with them.
Hmm. And what do the mushers eat? You mentioned that, M&Ms are pretty much off the list. What are they eating to keep themselves going?
I marvel at these people who live this myth of the frontier. And you ask them, well, gee, what do you eat? And I had a friend who lived really so close to the frontier up there that all he ate the whole way was salmon jerky. That he just did stuff down there. He wasn't much concerned about what he was eating. Another musher I know ate nothing but chocolate chip cookies that she'd baked for the race. You just kind of throw a few of them down deep in your parka where they're going to warm up. It wasn't really a culinary trip. I ate a little bit of moose stew and fried beaver and a few other things when you're out there. Not many vegetables, I might tell you.
Yeah, well, you need protein and you need fat, I guess.
Fat is good.
In that climate, it certainly is. Another interesting thing was that it's important to have the dogs well-rested, but the mushers necessarily are not well-rested.
Well, you can train for almost anything. This was one of the magic moments in this race when I realized that you can train for the physical hardship and you can equip yourself for the cold, but there's really nothing you can do for exhaustion. And you can imagine this race, dogs tend to run and rest in about equal measure. Run for 2 hours, rest for 2 hours. During that two-hour rest, a musher, you've got 14 dogs, you have to take the booties off. We talked about the sand, or the snow being as cold, like mm-hmm. sand, abrasive. They wear little fleece booties. You have to take those off, rub their feet, give them a pet of encouragement. Your life depends on them. Melt snow, cook some dog food, feed them. Well, they're getting rest in between all of this, but at the end of 2 hours, you, the musher, haven't got much rest, so you're off moving again. And that goes around the clock for 2 weeks. And at the end of that time, people are pretty dopey, I'll tell you.
Yeah. What do they do at the end of the race? I mean, do they just, collapse and sleep for 3 days or what?
That's exactly why Fairbanks and Whitehorse swapped the start of the race, because at the end of the race, everybody disappears. And the merchants and the taverns and the never get any business at the end of the race. People just disappear, and they kind of emerge, 3 weeks later with big sleepy eyes and a big smile on their face, and they ask, well, how did I do?
Do To say these dogs are eager to get out on the trail seems an understatement from what you've seen and written about. Give us some sense of the desire on the part of the dogs.
Well, you hear these stories, how eager these dogs are to run. And, of course, I go up there, and I'm a little suspicious because I've heard, as many of your listeners have heard, well, is mushing cruel? I mean, are these dogs forced to do this? You get out there after a while, and I spent two winters, and you think about having to hook up a team of dogs. I weigh 200 pounds. A sled dog weighs 50. And it's a pretty even match who's going to wrestle who into the harness. These dogs are bred to run. They know about running and the thrill of it. And to get 14 of these guys in there is just about as exhausting a job as I've ever been through. And then for the first few miles, you better hang on. They don't know the word stop at all. The eagerness of these animals is something to watch. And not only that, it's their relationship with the humans that I think makes this sporting event quite a bit different than many others.
Yeah, and the musher has to have a really strong relationship with his dogs.
You leave town, you leave Whitehorse, and maybe there's, 500 spectators. I mean, it's a real crowd up there. You hardly find a parking spot. And in 300 yards, you have left this century, and you are back in the 19th century. I mean, things have not changed there. And you have this very strange feeling. I did quite a bit of mushing myself and mushed part of this trail. And you suddenly realize that your life depends on these animals. And then you have a second realization that their lives depend on you. And for the next 2 weeks, 1,000 miles, you exist in this dependence that I know no equal of, where human and animal are bonded together for their survival. And it's quite a wonderful sensation to watch those people who do it well.
Yeah. Team and musher are bonded as one. And you write in the book, noting here the title right away, Yukon Alone, you write, it is 38 simultaneous 1,000-mile races, each one occurring in a discrete bubble of space, 38 being the number of mushers out there in 1998.
You can imagine, since we're right next to the Arctic Circle, the days are 17 and a half, or the nights are 17 and a half hours long, so it's mostly dark. You can see as far as your headlamp will shine, which is to your lead dog, because that's all the musher needs to see, is make sure that the dogs are running well. The dogs take care of following the trail. And these guys spread out over vast distances. Some of them have a strategy that they'll go for 3 hours, and the next guy only goes two. And then within a matter of the first day, they're spread out over, long distances. And at the end of the race, they're spread out days apart in true wilderness. So it's 38, in this case, 38 adventures going on all at once, not one event.
Mm-hmm. And the dogs have different roles. You just mentioned lead dogs. There are also swing dogs and wheel dogs. Tell us about the different roles the dogs play.
Well, the dogs in the front obviously are the what we call the lead dogs. And you've got to have dogs that these dogs don't just have trail sense. They are the cheerleaders. They're the ones that get up and get everybody else to thinking that the best thing to do is wake up after 2 hours sleep and run for two more hours. They're the kind of dogs with this contagious energy. Once in a while, you'll see one at the park, and you say, now that's a lead dog, because everybody wants to go with that dog. Then behind the lead dog are these animals, the team dogs, the pullers. You know, they might not be too smart or too trail-wise, but they have a lot of get up and go. You get further back in the team, and the dogs right next to the sled, you know, if this sled is full of all of that dog food, it might weigh 300 pounds, and it's jostling around, and you need some really strong dogs back there to handle that jostling. And then right in front of them are the swing dogs who kind of help swing on corners. You don't, if everybody turned at once, you can't do a right angle turn. So they're dogs that tend to help the whole team get around a corner. So everybody's got a job, although the truth is that people rotate dogs quite a bit. Somebody gets tired of doing one job, they'll let them do the other one for a while.
Yeah. Now the man or woman on the sled, are they steering or are the dogs taking care of that?
A little bit of both. I remember the first time I went out, you learn by having two sleds hooked together. You don't run your own dog team. There's a musher in front of you. And I said, now, how do you steer? And this guy who had won the Iditarod said, I don't know. And I said, what do you mean you don't know? And he said, well, I can't tell you how to ride a bicycle either. There's a lot of physical activity going on. And sometimes you want to aim away from objects, and sometimes you want to aim into them. And it's a little bit like cross-country skiing, snowboarding, hang gliding, and rodeo riding, best I can tell. And you know, I only spent 2 years and never got really good at it. But I can't tell you how to get around a corner either, except that I know the dogs, they'll get themselves around. But you've got this big thing behind you or in front of you that you've got to get around.
Yeah. So, and I would imagine, I don't know, are good mushers, are they born or are they made?
Well, I think that this is an endeavor from the heart. You have to imagine that if you've got, say, a kennel of 20 or 40 dogs, that's your life. It's not just, oh, I'm going to gear up for a race and, you know, 2 hours a day I'll practice for a marathon. This is a devotion that you've given your life over to. You don't ever take, quote, vacation and go away. It's a means to get into the outdoors. These are people that that love the outdoors. I like to think of them as people that are much like our ancestors. Through most of human evolutionary history, we lived in proximity to animals by the rhythms of the seasons, according to nature. And these people probably have a residual gene that runs a little stronger in them, and that's how they live today. It's very old-fashioned, and in some ways it's a very elegant and also a very difficult life.
Mm. Now, how are these folks seen by others in the far north? At one point in the book, you mentioned that someone says, oh, he looks like a musher. Is that what does a musher look like? And you know, is that a compliment, or is that a way of saying they're a little different from you and me?
I think it's a little of both. Mushers are greatly admired in the far north. That's one of those measures by which men and women up there judge achievement. Most Alaskans and Yukoners live for winter. Winter, you've got to be tough to get out and enjoy it, and mushers do that. On the other hand, if your son or daughter came home and said, Dad, I think I've decided to be a musher, I don't think your heart would soar. It's one of those groups of people that we admire, and we hope that we don't catch the virus and become one.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is journalist John Balzar. We're talking with him about the Yukon Quest. Yukon Alone is the title of his book that he has written about the 1998 quest, Yukon Alone, the World's Toughest Adventure Race. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite your telephone calls in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Back to this idea of the dogs and is this cruel? Animals can become sick and injured during the quest, and some have died on the Yukon Quest. Are injuries and or death frequent?
Well, certainly deaths are not frequent. Now, death is a tragic moment on any sled dog race. Injuries are certainly more common, but I wouldn't say that there's a lot of hurt and injured dogs. Dogs lose their spirit. Dogs sprain an ankle. They do the ordinary kind of things that happen when you're pushing yourself in the outdoors. It's an interesting and complex subject. I write for the Los Angeles Times. I'm not going to go up and glorify something that's cruel to animals. I went up, looked at it. I think the animal rights people have done a great job in bringing scrutiny to this race, making it hard to be a bad musher. On the other hand, I say dogs in the world need all the friends they can get, and some of the best friends that dogs have ever had are dog mushers.
Mm. And there is quite a bit of vet support up there during this race.
There were 8 vets on the race the year I was there, and no doctors. If you got sick or you cut yourself, I guess I saw a guy chop his knee wide open with an axe. It was a vet who sewed it up, and they did a pretty good job of keeping the dogs and the people going.
Yeah, this also can be very dangerous for the mushers. There is risk of injury and death, and there was a death some years back.
There was, but you know, ice is a living thing. You spend a lot of time in this race on ice, on rivers. There's water moving underneath. They open up. I am always amazed that more people don't die. I was drawn to this race because it seemed authentic and it seemed like a real adventure to me. And it also appealed to me because while it had all this elements of adventure, it was not one of those things where, you know, every fourth person died or somebody dies all the time. And we certainly have a lot of that in our society and culture. I was drawn to this race because the foolhardy don't even try, and the people who go out are pretty sophisticated in woodcraft, and these animals are real smart, and that combination seems to get them down the trail in the doggondest ways. You know, when I'm out there, I was a menace, both to myself, the dogs, and the rest of the race, but some people looked after me a little bit. I'm amazed more people don't perish, frankly.
Well, somebody said to you, I think it was Rusty Hagen, and said, John, the idea here is not to have an adventure.
There were a lot of people up there. I went up to, and they kept telling me, no, this is not an adventure. This is, you know, an adventure is when something goes wrong. But these are the kind of people that live differently than you and I. These are the kind of people that one of the guys up there crashed his bush plane and spent the rest of the winter living off of animals that he could trap, waiting for spring so that he could build a raft and float out. Now, he said, now that's an adventure. But it wasn't like it was a big adventure. It was just that, well, unfortunately, that winter I had to spend, you know, living off the land. And to me, that would probably be pretty close to the end of life. I'm not too sure that if I'd have crashed my plane in the wilderness, I would have survived winter, let alone said, well, now that's an adventure.
Let's talk with some listeners. First, we're going to talk with a listener on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. You were talking about the way that mushers are looked at in the north and brought to mind a memory. I used to work in Anchorage, Alaska, and there was a respiratory therapist in the neonatal intensive care unit, Harry Caldwell, who did the Iditarod. And I can remember how people did all sorts of things to sponsor him and raise money for him, and he was held in highest regard by the people up there. And I also remember the joy of getting out the map from the Anchorage Daily News and following the route and finding out who was in first place and third place and everything, and how the dogs were doing and how the mushers were doing. And it's a wonderful event to follow, and I'm sure the Yukon Quest is the same. Although I lived in Anchorage, I don't really remember following the Yukon Quest as well as we did the Iditarod, but I sure am enjoying your program, and I'll look for the book when it comes out.
Well, that's great to hear. You know, the Yukon Quest was started specifically by people who had thought that the Iditarod, which most people know, had become a little too famous and a little too fancy. And it's become one of those things like upstate New York and New York City, or Chicago and downstate Illinois. There's two separate worlds there, and they often don't communicate. It's regional differences, it's cultural differences. There's a mountain range that divides them. And so you really have two races, and one of them is famous and one of them isn't.
And the folks that are involved in the Yukon Quest, they think it's much tougher to run that than the Iditarod. Maybe you would offer us some examples of how it's tougher.
Well, it's tougher in some ways. It's tougher in physically. There are fewer checkpoints on the race. That means the loads and the sleds are heavier. The hills are much higher. That means more work to get up them. It is vastly colder in the interior of Alaska. So, the temperatures of 40 and 50 below are common. That's much colder usually than the Iditarod. On the other hand, let's not diminish the Iditarod. A finisher's patch from the Iditarod is a heck of an achievement. That is a much more competitive race. You would have to work harder to win the Iditarod, but you'd probably have to work harder to finish in the quest.
Let's talk with another listener. On line two in Urbana, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Hi, Celeste.
Hi.
Hi, this is Jim.
Jim Keel, who has Malamutes.
I have Malamutes, and I want to tell a Malamute story about a friend of ours, Jamie Nelson, who has not run the quest. But she did run the Iditarod three times, and she's won the Bear Grease two or three times. Regarding Malamutes, Jamie tried to run the only all-Malamute team in the Iditarod and got about 500 miles and had to drop out. And the other two times she ran the Iditarod, she used Alaskans or, you know, or Huskies. So we asked her what was the difference between running the Malamutes and running the Alaskans. And she said something that was relevant to what you were talking about earlier. She said the Alaskans love to run. And so after she would go to a checkpoint and take care of all the dogs, get back out on the trail, she would just strap herself to the sled and go to sleep. And the dogs would just follow the trail, and she'd wake up a few hours later, and she'd still be on the trail. With the Malamutes, she tried that, but as soon as she fell asleep, the Malamutes would stop. They weren't about to run because they thought this racing thing was kind of silly, and they weren't about to run unless they were made to run. So she had to stay awake, not only at the rest the checkpoints, but she also had to stay awake on the trail. And she said it was a lot harder driving the bigger, slower Malamutes, not because they were bigger and slower, but they had to be driven. They didn't see the point in racing. I just wanted to share that story. That's what I was thinking about when you were talking about the dogs liking to run and the checkpoints and sleep.
You know, in this race, Celeste, the race that I wrote about, there was an interesting thing that happened that there are all kinds of conventions and quote, rules that come up, and one of them is that these big dogs like Malamutes and Siberian Huskies are no longer competitive in long-distance dog mushing. And out of the blue, this mysterious French-Canadian, André Nadeau, appears at the starting line with a whole team of Siberians. And nobody took this man the least bit seriously. It was like showing up, you know, with a Mazda at NASCAR. And he went down the 1,000 miles with a completely different strategy, not knowing what the rules that Alaskans had. Alaskans said, you got to run really fast for 2 hours and then rest for 2 hours. Well, this guy said, well, that isn't the way I run. The way I run is I just run all the time. So it became a tortoise and hare race. And he really has turned dog mushing on its head. People are now rethinking everything because André came within a whisker of winning with a strategy that everybody had thought was impossible.
Yeah. I want to thank Jim for his call this afternoon. Jim and his wife Robin raise Malamutes, and they are beautiful, magnificent dogs. And Jim joins us once a month with another dog trainer by the name of Carol Lindholm. They join us on the first Friday of the month, and we talk about dog training and dog behavior. And it's always a very enlightening time and a lot of fun to visit with Jim and Carol. His call, John, makes me ask this question very directly. You know, what makes a good dog at the front end or anywhere in that team of dogs? What makes, you know, how do the mushers select those 14 dogs? Because presumably they're going to have a lot more than 14 to choose from.
They call it head. It's that sense of contagious spirit and determination and that kind of curiosity that I got to know what's around the next corner and I got to know what's up the next hill. And I think it's also a devotion. People understand the love of their pets. You come home from work, and Fido starts slobbering and going crazy, and it's a wonderful unrestrained love from an animal. Well, the more of that in a sled dog, the better, because you're going to have to convince that guy. Yes, I know it's blowing, and it's 30 below, but you've got to get up because if you don't get up, then nobody's going to get up. And there are accounts where, you know, all the dogs lose faith, and a musher has to get out in front and say, okay, if I go, will you go? And the dogs say, well, okay, if you lead, we'll go. And, you know, there's an episode in this book where the guy who won the race had to get out and convince these dogs that it's the right thing to do to keep moving. So it's that combination, and it's a bit of magic. I think it's unlike thoroughbred horses where you need a horse that's just, you know, bloody fast. You need a dog that can do this for 2 weeks with the, and it's that combination of love and strength and head.
Well, they call it head, but it's really heart.
It's really heart. You're right. That's probably a much better word, except that Alaskans don't want to get too gooey and, you know, start talking about heart. You know, then you lose the Jack London myth.
Yeah, you don't want to have a mushy musher.
Right. Well said.
Also, another thing that the last caller, Jim Keel, mentioned is, you know, this woman, you know, settling down on her sled and going to sleep, resting while the dogs run. The dogs know where the trail is. In the Yukon Quest, it's dark much of the time, and there are hazards on the trail. There, you can come across open water and the like. How do dogs and musher navigate the trail?
Well, that's an interesting question. I want to go back to something that Jim said, though, and that was about tying yourself into this sled. Let's make sure that people understand that's just about the most dangerous thing that you can do. I have a friend who's in the hospital paralyzed from the neck down for doing just that. That's a shortcut. I won't question his friend, the musher, but I would tell your listeners, don't ever tie yourself into a sled. The idea is that you may be so tired that you're thinking, okay, I can't let these dogs go. If I fall off, they're just going to keep going. So I'm going to tie myself in. But if you have the sled tips over in a corner and then they're dragging you and they drag you into a tree, it's an awful thing. To your question about navigation, it's remarkable to me. I'll give you an example. A friend of mine up there who's a newspaper editor went on a 250-mile race. That's a quarter of the length of this one. In an area where the trails were very well marked, he disappeared and was given up for dead, lost for 14 days. Couldn't find his way down 250 miles. Just completely got lost, and they didn't think he would survive. So when we talk about these people making it 1,000 miles, these are folks with tremendous woodcraft skills, bushcraft. They know the topography. Part of this race occurs on a river. It's fairly easy to find your way down a river, although the river's 2 miles wide and full of block ice. But then you have to go upside creeks, over mountain passes, and you rely a lot on the trail sense of dogs. But you have to be attentive, too. You're going down a trail, and the dog is maybe smelling the trail of the team that's, you know, a half a day in front of you. And that's fine, except that dogs get bored, and they say, hey, a moose crossed this trail. That's much more interesting. So they veer off to follow the moose. They think they're having fun. If you aren't attentive, if you've tied yourself into the sled and are asleep, you could wake up some entirely strange place and not know where the heck you are. So it's a lot of paying attention to the topography, the trail sense, and, you know, at least for the guys in the front, the trail is marked with stakes just before the race begins. That doesn't always help the guys in the back when the stakes blow down, but it's an odd combination of dog, human, and map.
Yeah. You write in the book that for the men and women who make the quest, it's a private testimonial to the values of the far north, and you say that you eventually came to realize that the ways of life in the subarctic were sources of mystique and of hope. Talk with us about that.
Well, I have fallen for this whole theory of evolutionary psychology, that we were bred to be a certain kind of thing, a certain kind of animal. And that involved our relationship very much to nature and the seasons and, again, animals. And the folks up there, I think, have a lot to teach us. I'm not saying that they teach us all we should run out and buy 40 dogs and become dog mushers, but they live very satisfying, purposeful lives up there without gathering up a lot of wristwatches and fancy jewelry and vacation homes and other things. And I looked at them and I thought, well, I compared them to many of my friends who talk about being stressed and neurotic, and I began to think that, well, maybe some of my friends outside down here in the lower 48 in the big cities need to reconnect a little more with nature. And you see that happening all over. We all see that, you know, people trying to get back, crawling their way back into nature. Why? Because that's home. And the folks up there do live, you know, on the myth. This is the edge of the frontier, and to watch them, you realize that there's a reason that that's the great American myth.
Yeah. Now you live in the lower 48 in Oregon. Has this experience of being in the far north changed you? Changed how you live in the lower 48?
Well, as a matter of fact, Celeste, it has. I went up there looking for adventure. You never know what that's going to happen, and I fell in love up there.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm now living in Oregon with a woman who's my wife, who I met on the trail. So it's no small thing to say that this race really did change my life.
Yeah. And in terms of collecting wristwatches or whatever, has it changed you in that respect?
Oh, indeed it has. I've been kicking around up there for a dozen years and trying to learn. I mean, we all try to learn what is the meaning of life, and I spend a good deal more of my time trying to enjoy life than trying to accumulate those things that ward off the pain in life. I can't say I've done 100%, but I have tried to learn from those people that I admire, and I admire those folks up there very much.
Yeah. Are you still seen as an outsider?
I am, and I intentionally emphasize that. I mean, that's outsider with a capital O. That's the way they refer to outsiders. I mean, you either are or are not an Alaskan. And even though I think over a dozen years I've probably traveled more of that state than most Alaskans have, I haven't given the commitment. And folks up there, you know, the ones that I admire, have pretty good noses for what's authentic and what isn't. And the last thing you want to do is go up and say, hey, I'm one of you, when they know perfectly well that you're not. So I haven't yet given the commitment to uproot myself and live there. And so I am and may always be an outsider, but I'll always be a friend and spend as much time as I can up there.
Yeah. So how did you get to know the folks of the far north? I would imagine being an outsider with a large O, capital O, makes it tough to really... It can make it tough to connect, although I think you've made some great connections.
You know, the marvelous thing about people up there is they are much less guarded than folks down here. I can promise you, if you're driving on the Alaska Highway in the winter and you have a flat tire, the first car that comes will stop for you. People don't have that same need to be self-defensive. So if you go up there and you say, look, I want to learn about your life and the things you do, it is probably 50 times easier up there than down here. If I walked into your life and said, gee, I'd really like to spend time with you and see what you do, I think your suspicions, as mine would all go up. But in Alaska, people are just less afraid. They've been less damaged. They're less under assault by media and images and so forth. So I found them uncommonly open, and they would do amazing things. You know, I'd say, I want to learn about dog mushing, and they would borrow dogs from friends and get you a team and spend days, weeks teaching you this when they had better things to do with their time. But you asked, and they said, okay. It's not like asking your neighbor to borrow a lawnmower. If you ask somebody up there something, their chances are that they'll take it seriously.
Yeah. I kind of suspect that because of the terrain and the conditions and how harsh life can be, it's very important for folks to be able to count on one another for all kinds of things.
Exactly, and they have the luxury to do that. The rule up there, for instance, is any wilderness cabin, you can't lock it in the winter. I mean, it's just, you know, it's an ironclad rule. If you're traveling in the wilderness, not on the road, but on the wilderness, and you come across a cabin, you're entitled to seek shelter there. And you can expect that the person who's going to seek shelter there is going to leave something behind, as well as maybe use some of your firewood, will probably chop some. So they have the luxury of being open. We wouldn't have that here. You wouldn't say, gee, if you're passing through Illinois, you can just stop at my house any old time, any of you. That'd end pretty quick, I think.
I think so. Let's talk with another listener, this one on the toll-free line in Sumner. Good afternoon.
Hi there. I find this kind of interesting. We happen to be following this race on the web, and I have a niece who has a friend who is in the race and quite a bit of interest in watching these checkpoints and all this stuff when they start. I'll just ask you a couple of questions here, and then I'll hang up and you can talk about it. I'm sure they have snow and storms while the race is going on. How do they handle those? And what kind of, sleeping arrangements do they have for the humans or the dogs while they're on this race and at the rest stops or whatever? And if it's so bitterly cold, how do they handle a drinking water situation?
Let's see if I can take those one at a time.
Yes.
Storms are can be very frightening. Usually, when it's 40 below, it's calm, and that's one degree of challenge. And usually, when there's a storm, it warms up. I think we know that here in the Midwest. So it's not quite so bitter cold, so you just get one degree of challenge, a trade-off for the other. Once in a while, however, you get those fronts that mix up, as we know about here in Chicago, and you can get bitter cold and a blizzard. And these guys are traveling between checkpoints. They resupply with food they've sent ahead to the checkpoint, but they're cutting it close, you can imagine. They don't want to carry a lot of extra weight. So they're down to a day's worth of dog food, and it's 40 below, and there's a 50-mile-an-hour screaming blizzard. Some groups of mushers have come very close to perishing. It's a balance between carrying enough food or risking yourself. Now you ask about sleeping arrangements. Mushers tend not to want to get too comfortable because they're going to pass out and sleep a long time. I'd say 90% of how they sleep is if they're going to catch 15 minutes, they just stretch out on the sled bag in between cooking dog food and figure that they'll wake up when their body's just about to turn to an ice cube. So they want to be miserable, never comfortable. I never have heard of a musher actually getting in a sleeping bag. The dogs, well, they take care of themselves. They burrow into the snow, and they're cozy and nice and warm, and they do a good job of taking care of themselves. And somewhere in there was a third question.
About the water, drinking water.
Yeah, you melt snow. There's no other way to do it, and you've got to do a lot because at 40 below, and you can imagine how much water you're evaporating as you move along. These dogs drink a tremendous amount of water, and melting snow is no fun for those of you who've done it.
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. We've kind of talked around this question that I'm going to ask next, but I don't think we've really come right up on top of it, and that is why. The top prize is $30,000, but it can cost $20,000 to prepare for the quest. It's not the money, because there's only one winner of that $30,000 purse. When you ask a musher why, what might you hear in response to that question?
Well, there's usually a catch in their voice. People tend to want to answer your question, and yet they don't have an answer. Why did you get into radio? Why did I become a writer? Why? Life just happened. But I've watched the pathways, and so I don't think you can put their answers don't come to words. You watch someone, they, for one reason or another, went up to Alaska, and Alaska grabbed them by the heart, as it's done a lot of people over the last 100 years. And Alaska, to many tourists, is a summertime event. But for most Alaskans, summertime is getting ready for winter. And then what are you going to do in the winter? Well, you want to get out. I mean, your relationship to Alaska is one person to nature. And then you look around, well, how am I going to get out? And a snow machine is kind of a noisy, you know, thing. And you look at these people that travel by dog, and it's quiet and beautiful. And they say, well, gee, I'd like to try that. And it's like I say, there's a contagious virus. They try it, and they think, this is really elegant. I am out camping with these animals. They're my best friends in the world. They never are going to betray me. And they become wild. Mushers, in many ways, are very strong loners, and they're out with these dogs, and that becomes the reason for living. And then they say, well, gee, I'm good at this, so I'll race. I think the pathway is something like that.
And the one thing we haven't really talked about, we've talked a lot about the harshness of it and how tough it is and how grueling, but we haven't really talked about how beautiful it can be.
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that. You know, and you're right. We all know, most of what we know, I think, comes from Jack London, who described all of this. Oh, one mistake and you're dead, and oh, it's bitterly cold and this and that. And he forgot to tell us just how beautiful it is. But imagine this. Imagine the world, the terrestrial land around you was all black and white. Snow, ice, shadow, trees, rock. And the sky above you from horizon to horizon in these great, deep, shivering belts of bright neon green and pink and reds. Alone in nature, the howl of a wolf. When you can see, even if it's just at a low light, it's like having a new pair of glasses. That the air is so dry at 40 below, it's just everything is vivid and clear, and it's breathtakingly, it's dreamily beautiful.
Mm. That's where we'll leave it. Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Bless, thank you.
And give our best to your folks up there in the far north when you see them again.
I'll do that.
Okay, take care. Our guest this afternoon in this portion of the afternoon magazine has been journalist John Balczar. He is the author of Yukon Alone, the World's Toughest Adventure Race. The book is now available in paperback from Owl Books, a division of Henry Holt. This evening in the Chicago area, John will give a reading. He'll also show slides and sign copies of his books, Yukon Alone, at the bookstall in Winnetka. That is located at 811 Elm Street, and the time for that is 7 p.m.